This is Frank Gaffney with a word about a truly great American patriot in urgent need. Rich Higgins served in the U.S. Army and as a key civilian Pentagon official and senior strategist on President Trump's National Security Council. After he left the NSC, Rich continued advising Mr. Trump and others about the threats we are facing from enemies, foreign and domestic. He chronicled his experiences over the past 20 years fighting for America First in a terrific memoir entitled The Memo. Now this courageous freedom fighter is gravely ill due to severe complications caused by the Chinese Communist Party virus. He urgently needs help to defray the enormous costs of successive surgeries and a prospective organ transplant. I urge you to join me in contributing to a GoFundMe campaign named Medical Help for Rich Higgins. That's Medical Help for Rich Higgins at GoFundMe.com. God bless you and Rich Higgins.
Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing in the war for the free world. A woman in the front lines of our neighbor to the north, Canada, in the war for the free world is the great Christine Douglas Williams. She is a 9-time international award-winning journalist and television producer. She has served inside the Canadian government as the director of the Canadian Race Relations Foundation for a time. She has been a published author, including an important piece for the Center for Security Policy Press about some of her experiences with the Canadian Race Relations Foundation. And she is a very active contributor to our dear friend Robert Spencer's Jihad Watch, where you can find her writings at jihadwatch.org. Very, very important research and resource material. It's great to have you with us back, Christine. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes.
Once again, a pleasure and a privilege.
Let's start with very important news out of Canada, and that is that a parliamentary commission and an independent effort out of, I guess, initially Hong Kong, has been warning about a phenomenon that I'm afraid is much in evidence here as well, if you have the wit to look for it. But talk about Chinese Communist Party influence operations in Canada, Christine.
Frank, it's been described as outright alarming. Now, this group that you mentioned, it's called Alliance Canada Hong Kong. This is a nonpartisan group that's driven by pro-democracy Hong Kong people in Canada. It supports like the Taiwanese, the Tibetans, the Uyghurs, and other communities that are suffering from the tyranny that goes on as a result of the Chinese Communist Party, including the tyranny and the targeting of dissidents right here in Canada. Now, the Alliance Canada Hong Kong tabled a report at a special House committee in the House of Commons on Canada-Chinese relations. And most alarming was the extent of influence that was reported according to this report. And it emphasized that the influence is going unnoticed by the general public. Now, this group accused China of interference, widespread interference in media, even controlling certain Canadian politicians and forming deep partnerships with universities, particularly, and businesses. Now, it's sad to say, but we see a similar pattern of Iran's incursion into Canada. The subject is China now, but we're seeing a similar front. So we've got two fronts there. And the intimidation and surveillance on Chinese nationals in Canada is what was emphasized. For example, the United Front Work Department Agency, which is coordinating Beijing overseas influence operation, including the mobilization of students, is very active here in Canada. And CSIS, now that is the Canadian Security Intelligence Agency, they took a rare step to name China. And this was another report out of the CTV News. But they named China as a significant threat to the country's sovereignty, with no response coming in from Ottawa. This is CSIS saying this. They unveiled, in fact, that in a redacted version of the National Security and Intelligence Committee of Parliamentarians, and that was done in 2020, that in a redacted version of that report, the threat it set from espionage and foreign interference is so significant, and it continues to grow. And the report highlighted that China and Russia remain the primary culprit. And this threat of espionage and so forth, it's particularly active on campuses and in student groups where we're seeing exchanges of information and intelligence and so forth changing hands. And it's the money, Frank, that's being circulated here, the economic wealth that manipulates Canadians into a massive interference campaign. It's so deep are the Chinese coffers here that with the help of Western enablers, it's creating a troubling relationship of a long-term dependence that we're seeing coming from this country with China.
Yeah, it's penetration, it's influence operations, it's subversion. One thing that we won't have time to get into at length today, but I think is also a manifestation of what the Chinese are up to, of course, is just the sheer purchase of real estate in your country. And we're seeing it happen on this side of the border as well. In fact, my commentary today is about a purchase of 200 square miles of Texan land by a former Chinese People's Liberation Army general. I mean, what could possibly go wrong?
What you say is extremely important, and it all involves the bottom line of influence in this country and the loyalty of its nationals and the harassment to continue that level of infiltration.
Does. These are ominous things. We're so appreciative that you're tracking them and hope that you will come back to us with updates on it. Christine, I did want to ask you about one other thing that you've written about recently at jihadwatch.org, and that is the role that the Anti-Defamation League is playing. It is an organization that for many years was at the forefront of trying to protect Jews and others from the effects of anti-Semitism. What role is it playing these days?
In short, Frank, the woke role. This is the disturbance that we have seen, a pattern of the ADL. It was once, as you indicated, a very influential, helpful group to the cause of anti-Semitism, but it has now joined on. It has linked itself onto wokeness, where we see issues of this organization becoming politically involved. And as with any woke organization, there are two special interest groups. We see Muslim Brotherhood interests, we see Black Lives Matter, and these are the kinds of causes that we see in the name of human rights, this whole victimhood narrative that the ADL has come out with, not even accepting or discussing in its historic reports of anti-Semitism about the whole jihad factor, the Islamist factor, but
a preeminent driving force behind anti-Semitism, let's be clear. Yeah. And you know, what's troubling about this on our side of the border is that the Anti-Defamation League is among the groups, we're told, along with the Southern Poverty Law Center, another discredited, disreputable organization, I can say from firsthand experience, and some elements of the Muslim Brotherhood as well, it seems, are now playing a role in the purging of patriotic warriors from our military by the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, and his right-hand man, a fellow by the name of Bishop Garrison. And this is profoundly troubling because, as you say, this group has morphed beyond recognition and is now, it seems, playing for the other team.
And this is something that needs to be recognized more by the mainstream public in America, in the United States, and virtually everywhere.
And when you look at the impact that this group is having, is it fair to say that by sort of drawing on and exploiting its previous role, its previous credentials, its previous contributions, it is giving a patina of legitimacy to some very dubious customers indeed?
You hit the core of the matter. We have organizations like the ADL and like the Southern Poverty Law Center, both of which started out with a pure cause and genuinely fought for human rights, that has mutated into this nothing. It resembles nothing of its original calling. It's become a political activist entity, people smearing people, branding people, and in itself, it becomes an alliance with the very problematic forces such as Islamism that we see.
Hate groups, one might say, indeed. Christine Douglas-Williams, we are hard out of time. Fascinating conversation with you, as always. I hope that, as I say, you'll join us again soon with, updates on both of these important fronts, if you will. Thank you for your time today and the great work you do now every day at jihadwatch.org. Check it out, folks. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang. We'll talk bit more about what China's up to here and elsewhere with one of our country's great leaders on that subject right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, and it's time for one of the highlights of our week. Each week, right out of the box, we get to chat with Gordon G. Chang. He is one of our country's great authorities on the threat of our time, the Chinese Communist Party. He has written prolifically on the subject, both in book-length forms, notably The Coming Collapse of China and the Great U.S.-China Tech War. He is also contributing mightily to our periodical literature through a number of publications, including Newsweek and the Gatestone Institute. You can follow him, as I do, at Gordon G. Chang. It's good to have you with us, sir. Welcome back.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Well, there's several things that we've been talking about for a bit, Gordon, that I'd like to update on, because there seems to be new news on the subject. First and foremost, the provenance of the Chinese Communist Party virus seems to be becoming more and more a matter of consensus in the United States after a lot of disinformation, a lot of, well, efforts to suppress evidence and, for that matter, the truth. Mike Pompeo was on with Maria Bartiromo over the weekend, and in that vehicle and others, he has been fairly insistently on the net about what's now becoming a matter of well, as I say, I think consensus. Tell us where we are on the provenance of this virus and what it means.
Well, more and more people are coming to the conclusion, as former Secretary of State Pompeo has, that this originated from the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And indeed, there is a lot of evidence suggesting that. And maybe more important, Frank, there is now zero evidence, no evidence that this was a natural mutation. You know, the scientific community has overwhelmingly endorsed that idea of a zoonotic transfer, but no one has been able to find the reservoir of SARS-CoV-2, the pathogen, and no one has been able to document the transmission links. Though we do have substantial evidence that this did leak from the lab, as we have learned in recent weeks from the Wall Street Journal, that three researchers at the Wuhan Institute fell ill with COVID-like symptoms in November 2019. The wife of a Wuhan Institute researcher died with COVID-19 symptoms the following month, December. And indeed, China has done its best, as very obvious, to cover up the origins. All of the signs are pointing to a lab leak.
Gordon, Francis Collins, who is the director of the National Institute of Health, has been heard to say in an interview with Hugh Hewitt last week that the Chinese scientists at this laboratory include some of the best in the world with respect to the kind of work they've been doing. Specifically, I guess, he's alluding to gain of function research on coronaviruses that the Chinese Communist Party has either been developing or at least exploiting. When you hear that a facility associated with the People's Liberation Army's illegal biological weapons program has some of the best scientists in the world associated with it, what does that signal, as far as you're concerned, especially given your understanding and warnings, notably in Newsweek last week, about the character of that research?
Well, that assessment points to, I think, something that's becoming indisputable, and that is China has a prohibited biological weapons program. Gain-of-function experiments are indistinguishable from weapons research, and it's prohibited in the United States, considered to be too dangerous. We know that Dr. Fauci authorized a grant in fiscal 2014 to Echo Health Alliance, a New York NGO, and that money was supposed to be used and was used, sent over to the Wuhan Institute for bat coronavirus research. Whether Fauci wanted it or not, that money was used in gain-of-function experiments. We know that because scientific papers have been issued which describe gain-of-function techniques. China has that program, and we have got to make a decision on our own what we do, because there's no inspection regime in the Biological Weapons Convention. China is violating it. We've got to do something, because As the Chinese military strategists say, World War III will be fought with biological weapons.
This is one of the chilling data points that you've provided, Gordon, as well as the evidence that they have quite deliberately pursued in this weapons program, the idea of being able to precisely target these biological agents to kill certain ethnicities or nationalities. It's chilling stuff. You have also written about the need for the Chinese to compensate the world for the damage that it has done on an epic scale. It seemed as though President Trump was channeling his inner Gordon Chang over the weekend when he talked about the price tag for such reparations being on the order of $10 trillion. What do you make of that estimate, Gordon? Does that sound approximately right to you? And it's also been suggested, I think, by Newt Gingrich, that the world might achieve those kinds of reparations by universally applying a 30% tariff to the Chinese exports to their various countries. What are your thoughts on, A, the magnitude of this prodigious cost to the world and how it might be compensated?
Well, as of this moment, Frank, more than 3.7 million people have died from the coronavirus, and that includes 597,000 Americans. There's no compensation for that. What we need to do is establish deterrence, because Chinese leaders, I believe, took decisions to deliberately spread this disease beyond China's borders. They lied about contagiousness. They forced countries to take arrivals from China while locking down their own country. They did other things. We cannot allow the Chinese to think that they can do this again, because as you point out, we know that Chinese researchers have openly talked about developing a new type of biological warfare with pathogens that will, as you say, leave the Chinese immune and attack all others, which means that the next disease from China could be a civilization killer, leaving China as the world's only viable society. We've got to stop China from doing that. And one of the ways to do that is to impose significant costs, $10 trillion, $100 trillion. The number has got to be enough to make sure that China doesn't do this again. And the one thing that we really need to do is to cut relations with China, because we do not need those passengers coming from that country that spread the disease the last time. We need to cut trade, cut investment, sever our relations with China. It's unfortunate, but there's probably no other way to do that to protect ourselves from the next disease.
You know, Gordon, I was just talking with Christine Douglas Williams, a brilliant journalist in Canada, about recent reporting up there and parliamentary reviews of the evidence that the Chinese have established such a massive influence operation in that country that the kinds of decoupling you're talking about would be unimaginable, I think, in that land. What are your thoughts, Gordon, about whether we might be able to accomplish it given the degree of influence operations and penetration taking place here?
Frank, yes, it's going to be difficult. Because of China's influence at all levels, exploiting all points of contact with us. But if we want to keep our country, we have no choice but to do this. And you're right, China is more influential in Ottawa than the United States is. Though I think the Canadian people, when they're surveyed, show that they are extremely skeptical of China. But Canada's business class and political elite are firmly in Beijing's camp. This is an existential crisis for us.
Hey, Gordon, quickly, one other thought. I did my commentary today on a brilliant Epic Times TV interview that our friend Kyle Bass did last week, I believe, talking about this so-called Morning Star Ranch down in southern Texas by the border near a U.S. Air Force base, a very important base at that, putting a 10,000-foot runway in and creating a wind farm that would have some impact on our electric grid. These all seem to be extremely ill-advised developments. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, that purchase of land near, I think it's Lackland Air Force Base, should have been prohibited by the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. It wasn't. It should now be reversed. We should not allow China to be buying land in the U.S. because it's not only around military facilities in Texas. Chinese parties are buying land throughout the American heartland. I think it's partly because China can't feed itself right now, had a food crisis last year, but we should not be allowing China to buy things in the United States, including land in Oklahoma, Kansas, Texas, and elsewhere.
Especially strategic parcels of it in huge quantities, 200 square miles, for heaven's sake. So it's been described as the size of the city of Tulsa, Oklahoma. And this is now going to be, I believe, kind of a forward operating base for the Chinese Communist Party in our country. If we're not careful, it's in the hands, after all, of a former Chinese People's Liberation Army general. What could possibly go wrong? Gordon, we have to leave it at that, my friend. Thank you, as always, for your clarity on all of these issues, as well as for sharing those important thoughts with us each week. It is deeply appreciated, and I know you will keep up the great work you do at Newsweek and the Gatestone Institute and elsewhere. And again, folks, be sure to follow Gordon at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter. It's great to talk with you. Come back to us again next week if you would. That and more straight ahead. This is Frank Gaffney with a word about a truly great American patriot in urgent need. Rich Higgins served in the U.S. Army and as a key civilian Pentagon official and senior strategist on President Trump's National Security Council. After he left the NSC, Rich continued advising Mr. Trump and others about the threats we are facing from enemies, foreign and domestic. He chronicled his experiences over the past 20 years fighting for America First in a terrific memoir entitled The Memo. Now this courageous freedom fighter is gravely ill due to severe complications caused by the Chinese Communist Party virus. He urgently needs help to defray the enormous costs of successive surgeries and a prospective organ transplant. I urge you to join me in contributing to a GoFundMe campaign named Medical Help for Rich Higgins. That's Medical Help for Rich Higgins at GoFundMe.com. God bless you and Rich Higgins.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. And I'm very pleased to welcome back to our microphones, man we haven't talked with in too long. His name is Lawrence Peck. He is one of the country's leading experts on a somewhat arcane subject, but an important one nonetheless, and that is the front groups that the North Korean government has operating in this country to mount influence operations on their behalf. It's kind of hard to believe, given how odious that government is, that anybody in America would want to be seen as aligned with, let alone actively supporting, such a government. But there are some, and we're going to talk with Lawrence about what they're up to in this country. But first, he's also an advisor for the North Korean Freedom Coalition, which is very concerned, and properly so, about Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea, who was in Washington last week to have a high-level meeting with President Biden. And I'm anxious to get his take on both what seems to have come from that meeting and how Moon has behaved before and since. It's good to have you back, Lawrence. Thank you very much for taking some time to join us here at Secure Freedom Radio.
Very happy to be back on your show, Frank. Thank you.
So what are we to make of Moon Jae-in? This is a fellow who is leading what we think of as a key American ally, East Asia theater, on the Korean Peninsula, of course. But he doesn't seem to behave one most of the time. What did he do in the run-up to this meeting, and how did it go at his summit with President Biden, and what has he done since?
Yes, well, as your listeners are very well aware, South Korea is and has long been a steadfast ally of the U.S. The problem is not in the people of South Korea. The problem is with the current ruling regime in South Korea and the Democratic Party of Korea, a leftist party which currently runs the roost there, and the head of that party and the president, Moon Jae-in, who is a leftist, who is an appeaser of North Korea and has been very friendly towards the Chinese Communist regime. As you know, last week there was the summit, which President Moon had with President Biden, and there were a lot of flowery statements and optimistic statements about the supposed health of the alliance and how everything is wonderful swimmingly between the two countries. But then there was some backtracking that went on, which I'd like to mention. After Moon returned to South Korea, which is somewhat troubling, there were three instances. The first one was that members of Moon's left-wing Democratic Party of Korea were pushing for an explanation to the Chinese communist regime, that they were urging Moon's diplomatic personnel to speak to the Chinese officials and to explain to them why we had to say these things that we did in Washington about the strength of the U.S. alliance and things like that, and perhaps kind of soothe the ruffled feathers in Beijing. And the second was that Moon's own foreign minister, formerly his national security advisor, now his foreign minister, had declared that there really isn't much of a difference between the North Korean concept of what they mean by the definition of denuclearization and the U.S. and South Korean concepts of that, which is absolutely false because there's a huge distinction, which has been the problem all along going back for the past several years in our attempts to get the North to fully and verifiably and permanently denuclearize, which is the North, in their concept of denuclearization, it really envisions the U.S. Removing all nuclear-capable assets. We don't have any currently nukes in South Korea at the moment, but all nuclear-capable assets from our bases in South Korea, from the seas and skies surrounding the peninsula, from Guam, from Okinawa, from Japan, and then maybe they'll consider getting rid of some of their nuclear weapons in addition, whereas, of course, our definition is completely different, that the North must live up to its past agreements and international commitments to fully denuclearize, regardless of what forced dispositions we may have.
Is it fair to say that the North Koreans' position has seemingly become more intransigent, more demanding, more unreasonable, one might say, because the Moon Jae-in government has been constantly pressing for a unification arrangement with the North on the basis of more or less the North's terms. In other words, it's pursuing an appeasement policy that doesn't seem to have earned the respect of the North, interestingly enough. In fact, it seems as though they heap contempt on the South Korean government at every turn. And yet, it's unquestionably, I have to believe, giving the North Korean regime confidence that it can do so with impunity. And I'd be interested in your take on that aspect.
That's a very good way of putting it, Frank. And I often refer to the fact that, in a sense, the South Korean leftist regime and the North Korean dictatorship are almost what you might call double teaming the U.S. It goes back to when Moon first came into office and is dealing with then President Trump, assuring that the U.S., that the North Koreans were serious and completely dedicated to full and complete denuclearization, which we know was hardly the truth. And it continues under the Biden administration. And of course, they're actually, the South Korean regime, the leftist regime there, is actually lobbying in the U.S. In conjunction with pro-North Korean forces here, and to push forward the policy agenda of the North Korean regime, and that is in two aspects. The first being pushing for a relaxation or possibly even end to U.S. sanctions on the North, economic and human rights pressure and sanctions on their economy, and secondly, to require the U.S. to agree to a no preconditions peace treaty or peace agreement with the North, in which we'd give them security guarantees and open up diplomatic relations with them based on some kind of vague promises of the North in the future. So in that sense, they're really all on the same page, opposed to what our interests are. I would also like to add that this pro-North movement in the U.S., or at least some of the groups and individuals involved, have direct ties to the North Korean regime. And I don't mean only traveling on friendship delegations there in the past before the travel ban on North Korea, but I mean more specifically in dealing with, in meeting with, in collaborating with North Korean intelligence agents who are based at the North's UN mission in New York.
And opposed to, I would argue, what are the interests of the South Korean people? And Lawrence, I know you contributed to an important report, which I've just had handed to me. I've not had a chance to look at it yet, but it seems to make a pretty compelling case that Moon Jae-in's government stole the parliamentary elections last year and may in the process have helped the Chinese, for example, perfect techniques that some believe they use to help influence our elections here as well. These are extraordinary charges. Grant Newsom, one of our colleagues here at the Center for Security Policy, has done some very impressive forensic work on all of this and contributed to this report as well. I understand you haven't seen the final document yet, but I just wonder, how important is the seeming electoral grand larceny of the Moon regime to the agenda that it is pursuing, evidently, despite its being at odds with the interests of the South Korean people, and I think the sentiment of a great many of them as well.
Well, certainly the sentiment of the majority of the South Korean people is fully in support of the alliance with the U.S. and the presence of U.S. forces in South Korea, just like Moon in his flowery diplomatic statements will pay lip service to. But of course, he's surrounded himself, and he also comes out of the milieu of a very far-left radical student activist group of the 1980s, some of whose members were involved in violence against U.S. interests in Korea and were advocates of the North Korean state ideology. And these are kind of the kitchen cabinet who he surrounded himself with. With regard to the point that you just made about China and its influence in Korea, I'd like to point out that in their April 2020 legislative elections, Chinese nationals were actually allowed to participate in some of the vote counting and sorting procedure. And furthermore, Moon is actually trying to make it easier for Chinese nationals to gain citizenship in Korea through their children that they may have living there with them, which would of course make them eligible also to vote in South Korean elections in increasing numbers.
So this is part and parcel really of what seems to be sort of companion piece of his strategy, first to endear himself to China's puppet in North Korea, and secondly, to also see if he can't become one himself and his country a client state along with the North. This is such a travesty. And again, what is stunning to me, Lawrence, and you're expert on the subject, is that we're now seeing evidence of Americans who are very supportive of this agenda on the part of Moon on the one hand and Kim Jong-un as well in North Korea. Talk about some of these Americans. Who are they? What are they up to? And what impact are they having, do you think?
Well, yes, that's my field of expertise, which I've been devoting many years to researching and monitoring and opposing, and that is the pro-North Korean movement in the U.S., and that is a very tightly knit network of overlapping organizations and individuals who collaborate with each other, basically to pursue the goals of the North Korean regime here within the United States. Some of them are hardcore, openly, even fanatically pro-North groups who boast of it, and others, perhaps the more dangerous kind because they operate in a stealthy fashion, are the front groups, the groups which declare themselves publicly to be merely peace and unification of the peninsula type of organizations, but are actually pro-North Korean in their basic outlook and are lobbying the U.S. government intensively in support of policies favored by the North Korean regime, and I would also add now favored by the Moon government, or they'll meet with and get very, very favorable hearings from members of our own Congress and Senate. For example, in the Senate, Bernie Sanders, and in the Congress, some of the individuals who are sympathetic to the pro-North movement and who are being lobbied by them intensively are individuals like Congressman Ro Khanna of California, Barbara Lee of California, Tlaib of Michigan, and of course, as your listeners won't be surprised to hear, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York.
Lawrence, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but this is a topic to which I hope we can return in the near future, because this kind of fifth column activity in our country is very worrying, and it's not an isolated event, heavens knows, but it is one that bears considerable watching. We appreciate your expertise in the matter and efforts you make to call the attention of the rest of us to this subset of the larger problem we've got with, Marxists in our midst. Thank you for your time today. Come back to us again soon, if you will. Next up, we'll speak with somebody else right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and it's a pleasure to say we're joined, as we are each week, by Bill Walton. He is a former captain of finance in Wall Street who has become a leader of the conservative movement and thought leader as well, now in the Washington, D.C. area. You can see his Bill Walton podcasts at your favorite podcast outlets. It's a terrific TV program that covers issues better than just about anybody else I can think of. He joins us each week to share some of his thinking and that of other conservative leaders about the state of our economy and the world, and we're always privileged to have him with us. Bill, it's good to have you. Welcome back.
Frank, great to be here. Quick plug for your shop, Center for Security Policy. We had Fred Flights and Mike Waller on last week, and the title was A Woke CIA is a Broke CIA. It's a fascinating look into our foreign policy establishment.
Well, good. Thank you. They're good men, and we're delighted to be able to share them with your audience. Let me ask you about a development that took place last week. Somewhat surprising, and the more so because it seems to be good news, Bill. What did you make of Joe Biden's executive order that seems to not only have kept in place, basically, the Trump order that is aimed at trying to reduce U.S. investment in Chinese companies, specifically People's Liberation Army-tied ones. The Biden executive order seems not only not to have kept it in place, but to have strengthened it a bit. Your thoughts?
Well, my first reaction was astonishment. It's the first thing that Biden has done that seemed to be interested in protecting the United States from foreign adversaries. And so on that count, it's very good news. Of course, as the phrase goes, devil's in the details. It singles out, 57 companies now that are added to the list, but it leaves off the list an awful lot of companies that might have free rein to raise capital here. And also, we don't know what else they traded for this. I mean, this was a surprise. And I think we're just going to have to wait and see how this plays out before we can feel that they're doing the right thing here.
Yeah, it is a bit of a surprise. And one of the things, as you say, that has been observed by some of our friends, you know, a list, an expanded list even, of Chinese companies that you should not invest in leaves an awful lot that you should not invest in that are not on the list. Because, as you know, Bill, the Chinese Communist Party can have any company do its bidding, and most of them are deeply involved in doing so as part of a so-called civil-military fusion.
Well, and the Chinese are masters at a shell game. We all know that. They move assets and industries around by fiat. And so you think you've captured something by putting a few companies on the list. You may be missing something altogether by those that are not. But at least it's a step forward from what Steve Mnuchin was not doing. He wasn't enforcing this at all. So I guess if we can say something nice, let's say it. This sounds good. Let's see what really happens.
Yeah, I think, as you say, the devil's in the details and will require close monitoring. We'll be doing that with your good help, I know. Let me ask you about another front in which there seems to be a worrying agenda advancing. The globalists amongst us seem to be making strides with something now called the global tax minimum and minimum tax, I guess I should say. Bill, what's that about, and what does it seem to be trying to institute in the way of a global taxing capability?
Well, meanwhile, while Janet Yellen was doing the right thing with this Chinese list of prohibited companies, she was over making a deal with the OECD to basically try to create a worldwide tax framework so that all countries would have exactly the same tax code. Now, that's a gross generalization, but that's in essence what they're doing. And it would accomplish...
This is at least with respect to corporations, right?
With corporations. Stepping back, and I'm always looking for some context here, tax competition is a good thing. Ireland, Hungary have benefited enormously by being a low-tax corporate location, and it's really boosted their economies. And you want companies, countries around the world competing for investment dollars through using an effective tax code, which frees up capital for its highest uses. And that's been a very good thing. When we reduced our corporate tax rate,
including for ours to be able to do that.
Well, yes, exactly. We, you know, when we reduced our corporate tax rate a couple of years ago, when Donald Trump was president, all that really did was bring us back into line with the rest of the world. It wasn't a great leap forward. And now the Biden administration, in order to finance these trillion-dollar deficits, is looking to gather corporate tax revenue. And one of the key pieces of this is that the revenue would be taxed wherever it is in the world, not just where the company's headquartered. And so this would draw tax revenue back in from all around the world into the U.S. Treasury. The odds of this happening are low. It's just enormously complicated, and it's going to be hard to get 157 countries to agree on this. And significantly, and to no surprise of yours, there's one country that is not playing in the sandbox, and that is China. And, you know, China recognizes that American companies are going to be at a significant disadvantage, and that we're also surrendering Washington's ability to tax corporations as it sees fit. And, you know, so it's
a sovereign decision.
And, you know, the Chinese intelligently want to retain control over China's tax policy as a tool to encourage more investment, much like I mentioned Ireland and Hungary. So
Bill, the other piece of this, which is really worrying to me, is that we've seen in recent years efforts made by these globalists to actually create a taxing authority, as well as, you know, to engineer certain tax provisions. Is that part of this deal, as you understand it?
Not yet. I'm not sure. I've not had time to study it.
Keep your weather eye out for that, as they say.
Keep a gimlet eye out for that. That would be the but again, Frank, the economy is recovering. At least the United States economy is recovering. The world economy really is not, from the effects of the pandemic. And the administration, and this would be Trump's goal in the old days, would be to focus on growth and getting the economy back. Instead, what they're doing is they're turning their eye to making the tax code more egregious at the corporate level. And of course, once again, this benefits entrenched large multinationals who can afford the armies of thousands and thousands of tax lawyers and accountants to comply with this. But if you're a U.S.-based tech company and you want to venture abroad, you're going to be faced with these same regulations that Apple or IBM or Johnson & Johnson, they're able to comply with this. You won't be able to afford the regulatory nightmare.
Hey, speaking of the globalist agenda, Bill, I'm told that we're starting to see more buy-in to the so-called ESG agenda on the part of corporate America. That's environment, social justice, and governance. Sort of, again, leftist, globalist effort to, well, among other things, institute the Green New Deal. What's going on with that and the driving force behind it and its implication?
Well, it is gathering pace. You may have read or seen that Exxon just had a hedge fund, which owned almost none of its stock, managed to get two people elected to the board of directors. And neither one of those two basically believes that we ought to be drilling for oil. They believe we ought to be doing wind and solar. Now, Exxon doesn't really do wind and solar, but that's the agenda. And so if you step back and look at what the ESG agenda would do for all of our corporations, it would take them out of what they do well and push them towards accomplishing social goals. And the net effect of this right now on the company's bottom line, I don't think we'll be able to see, because most of these big companies, their profits and margins are so high that they can absorb some of this. But if you take a step forward and look at the attempt to get corporations to invest in non-economic activities in order to accomplish a progressive woke agenda, It's got to hurt competitiveness. It's got to hurt return on capital, and it's got to hurt innovation and growth.
The economy and ultimately national security, I would argue as well. Bill, we have to leave it at that for the moment. So much food for thought. I appreciate you sharing it with us as you do each week generously with your time. Thank you for doing it. Come back to us again next week if you will. I hope the rest of you will return to us at the same time, same station tomorrow. Till then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.